The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer, staff writer at thetrumpet.com and instructor of international relations at Herbert W. Armstrong College. I am standing in for your regular host, Stephen Flurry. And we have an absolutely jam-packed show for you today. I haven't done this in a while, so I probably went a bit overboard in trying to squeeze in a whole bunch of things I wanted to talk to you about. We will hopefully talk about work that's going on right now to build a ship to go to Mars. We'll talk about one of the most important takeaways from the U.S. presidential debates. But first, I want to talk about one of the most important but most underreported stories of the week, and that is about a crisis brewing in Germany. A huge one, and one that we've not talked about, a particular crisis we've not talked about much on this station so far, at least not in the past week or so. Germany so far has largely remained insulated from the global financial crisis. That same crisis has caused chaos in southern Europe. Greece has gone through total political upheaval. But Germany's been doing okay economically, and that has gone a long way towards holding Europe together. But now things could be changing. And the big piece of news demonstrating that this week comes from Deutsche Bank. So to bring us up to speed, here's an update on Deutsche Bank from Reuters as of either this morning or last night.
It's an imposing lender with a long way to fall. The prospect of a Deutsche Bank collapse almost unthinkable.
If Deutsche Bank gets into trouble, we really are facing another Lehman Brothers moment, if not worse. It's a bigger bank.
No surprise then that after 2 days of record low share drops, following news of a possible $14 billion US fine, some are nervous. Die Zeit newspaper says the government is working on a rescue plan and is willing to take a 25% stake in the bank in an extreme emergency. That's been dismissed by the finance ministry, but with Italy's banks in crisis, ruling out a rescue could be tricky.
I think you've got to believe that really, with push comes to shove, the German government would have to save Deutsche Bank, not just for the sakes of the political ramifications with the likes of Italy, but also because it's a really interconnected global multinational bank that just so happens to be based in Germany.
Deutsche's CEO, John Cryer, knew he had to overhaul the bank when he took over in July last year. Jobs have been cut and assets sold. The latest to go, British insurer Abbey Life to Phoenix for $1.2 billion. But some wonder why it's taken so long.
Probably both the government and the heads of these banks in Europe have just been a bit slower to react and slower to kind of accept some of the problems. And maybe that just reflects the fact that the problems are just that much worse in Europe.
But face the music they must. Deutsche Bank perhaps taking some comfort from the fact that it's not the only bank facing monumental problems.
Monumental problems. This is a huge, important bank. As you heard, people are talking about this as potentially being another Lehman's Brother moment, the infamous bank collapse that triggered the 2008 financial crisis. Now, to give some of the background, Deutsche Bank has been in trouble for a while before the financial crisis. Its share price was nearly 120 euros a share, definitely well over 100 euros a share. At the start of this year, it was only barely over 20 euros a share. This week, it hit its lowest value since 1983. Currently, it stands, last time I checked, at just below 11 euros a share. So this bank, it's lost 90% of its value in terms of share price since the start of the financial crisis. Now, during that financial crisis, Germany has really been a rock of stability for Europe's economy. But if the bank at the heart of that economy starts going under, that's huge problems, not just for Germany's banking system, for the whole German economy. So this is far more than a problem just for rich German shareholders. It even has the potential to impact German Chancellor Angela Merkel personally, German politics as a whole, the euro crisis, the immigration crisis, all of Europe. George Friedman, the founder of Geopolitical Futures, he wrote a week ago, Germany is the fourth largest economy in the world, the largest economy in Europe, the lender of last resort, and the foundation of European stability. If Germany weakens or destabilizes, Europe destabilizes, and is not too extreme to say that if Europe destabilizes, the world can as well. So this is something that has implications for everybody, really. So Deutsche Bank, it's important all across Europe. And to help illustrate the importance of this bank to economies all across Europe, and also to help bring us up to speed with its current state, here's a report from Channel 4 News from the middle of February, when Deutsche Bank was last having, the time before last, that it was having serious problems.
Around £100 billion has been wiped off the value of shares since the start of February. At the eye of the storm is Deutsche Bank. Its shares have slumped by 14% over the last 2 days, despite its attempts to reassure investors. A one-off or a canary in the coal mine for wider financial woes? Joining us now, our economics editor, Paul Mason. How do we make sense of this roller coaster?
Well, the markets carry on sliding. The FTSE down 1%. German and French stock markets down between 1 and 2 today. These are notable falls for any day, but when they keep carrying on day after day, it is a big problem. Athens down 3% in a day. One third of its value wiped out since the start of the year. Now, what's clear is that people are cashing out of shares. Investors who hold shares.
So you see that people are worried about that bank all across Europe, and it was affecting share prices in London, in Greece. It's a major interconnected bank, and it's one of two banks right at the core of Germany's entire economic system. The other is Commerzbank. Commerzbank is also having trouble. They share the same long-term problems as Deutsche Bank. Before the financial crisis, their share price was around 300 euros a share. Now it is just over 6 euros a share. That's a stunning drop. I mean, you certainly feel sorry for anybody who had shares in either of those banks. It's gone from next to worthless compared to where it used to be. And its problems are also in the news. It is making an official announcement tomorrow, but it's already kind of come out that they're going to cut 9,000 jobs. They're going to give no dividends this year. And these banks, just to give us a sense for how important they are for Germany's economy, Deutsche Bank is older than the nation of Germany. It was founded, I think, about a year before Germany was. And historically, they were known as the Big Three. There was Deutsche Bank, Commerzbank, and Dresdner Bank. And they really provided the financing for most German companies as this German nation was starting out. And this continued throughout all of their history. In the 1980s, a German government study found that they controlled the voting authority of three-quarters of the shares in most big German companies. So just these three banks controlling voting for three-quarters of shares in most big German companies. They sit on boards of companies all across Europe. So a huge influence just on German business as a whole. Now, Dresdner Bank, they failed in 2008. They had to be bought out by Commerzbank. And Geopolitical Futures, they wrote, disaggregating Deutsche Bank from the German government's political goals or the structure of German corporations is impossible. They are inextricably linked. So major foundation of Europe's economy, but they're also linked to the global economy. A few months back, the International Monetary Fund, they basically declared Deutsche Bank the most dangerous bank in the world. They wrote that among globally systemically important banks, Deutsche Bank appears to be the most important net contributor to systemic risks. And by a globally systemic important bank, what they mean is that a bank whose collapse would impact the entire financial system. So people are really worried about Deutsche Bank. It's big, it's important, but what is the latest news? Well, here's a report from just under a couple of weeks ago on what's affecting Deutsche Bank from Reuters.
A Friday sell-off for investors this week. European stocks tumbling, especially financials, as markets digest news of another hefty fine. The US Department of Justice now wants Deutsche Bank to pay $14 billion for mis-selling mortgage-backed securities. The size of that amount taking many by surprise.
This headline figure is obviously extremely disturbing, particularly when you look at that value compared to the actual capital itself of Deutsche Bank. You're wiping out most of the value of the business. No, the reality, of course, is they won't have to pay that. We only have to look at the precedent for Goldman Sachs, and they ended up reaching a deal, so we'll probably see a number which is probably close to 4 to 5 billion, still a huge amount.
Negotiations on a settlement could take several months, and Berlin has asked for a fair result. Deutsche Bank itself saying it has no intention of forking out that much cash. But the ongoing legal troubles surrounding the German lender means its litigation bill has already hit billions of euros.
It's all very murky. For Deutsche Bank, it's important to get out of this misery at some point and to be able to say they're over these cases, no matter how expensive they are.
Deutsche Bank shares fell as much as 8%, and with the 2008 financial crisis still casting a shadow, there are worries others could also be clobbered.
So Deutsche Bank, as you heard, they got hit with this 14 billion euro fine. It'll probably be somewhere 4, 5, 6 billion. But according to their share price, Deutsche Bank is only worth 18 billion. And not only do they have this fine, they're hemorrhaging. They're losing money every year. They lost, just going by memory, I think it was around 7.5, 8 billion last year. They're expecting this year's losses to be even bigger. They're expecting to just continue to make these massive multi-billion euro losses for the next few years. So they are in serious financial trouble. Their credit only barely outweighs their debt. And so their shares continue to fall. This is putting more pressure on the bank. And then on Monday, Bloomberg reported on the rest of the latest news affecting this bank.
Stocks finishing the second session lower. Every single industry group falling today. Biggest decline for the benchmark gauge, the Stoxx 600, since July the 6th. What a different day to the week we just had. The biggest weekly gain last week since the middle of July. Deutsche Bank, the big story today. Shares falling to a new record on concern the lender's capital buffers will be undermined by rising legal charges, including the settlement tied to the sale of U.S. securities, which could cost as much as $14 billion, more than twice the $6.2 billion it's set aside for litigation. Chancellor Angela Merkel ruling out any state assistance for Deutsche Bank in the year heading to next September's election, according to Focus magazine. This year alone, Deutsche Bank shares down by 50%. What's happened since the highs in 2007? Back then, May 2007, this was a 102 euro stock. Today, it's a 10 euro stock. Do the math. That's 90%.
So that there's all these rumors now swirling about whether the government is going to bail them out, whether they're not. And all of this really puts Ms. Merkel in an impossible position. You know, Deutsche Bank cannot go bust. If she bails them out, then she... But so it will just really affect the whole economy. But then if she bails them out, then she's going to get the wrath of the voter. And she spent the last 5 years trying to stop other EU countries bailing out their banks. Matthew Lynn, he had an article in the Telegraph yesterday, and he wrote, if Deutsche does go down, it's looking increasingly likely that it will take Merkel with it, and quite possibly the euro as well. And he talks about how it's a very politically difficult rescue for Angela Merkel, about how Germany 2 years ago let the Greek banking system almost go bust to try and enforce their way. Germany's banks are in crisis, and Germany has insisted on enforcing rules that make it much harder for the government to bail out their banks. And he writes, for Germany to turn around then and say, actually, we are bailing out our own bank while letting everyone else's fail, looks, to put it mildly, just a little inconsistent. They write that in truth it would become impossible for Germany to maintain a hard line in Italy and possibly in Greece as well. But then he talks about, on the other hand, if Deutsche Bank does go down, if they didn't step in a rescue, this would be a huge blow to Europe's largest economy and the global financial system. He writes, no one really knows where the losses would end up or what the knock-on impact would be. It would almost certainly land a fatal blow to the Italian banking system, and the French and Spanish banks would be next. Even worse, the Eurozone economy, with France and Italy back at zero growth and still struggling with the impact of Brexit, is in hardly in any shape to withstand a shock of that magnitude. He concludes by writing, Merkel is playing a very dangerous game with Deutsche, and one that could easily go badly wrong. If her refusal to sanction a bailout is responsible for a Deutsche collapse, that could easily end her chancellorship. But if she rescues it, the euro might start to unravel. It is hardly surprising that the markets are watching the relentless decline in its share price with mounting horror. Now, it does seem almost certain that Deutsche Bank and probably Commerzbank will get some sort of state aid. And, you know, there's still now a lot of discussion on going on about just what... whether, you know, a lot of argument whether or not it will end up needing a bailout. I think James Quinn, he had an article in the Daily Telegraph this morning that made a great point. He wrote that in the drawn-out death spiral that was the collapse of Lehman Brothers, I spent hour after hour as this paper's man on Wall Street listening to the bank's executives and communication folk deny they had a problem. In March of that year, Lehman's chief financial officer, Eric Callan, trying to stem a run on the bank shares, which had fallen 46% earlier amid fears Lehman was the next Bernstein's, assured the bank had the leadership, the experience, the capital strength and the liquidity to ride out this period. So you had a lot of leaders back in 2008 saying everything is fine, everything is great, we've got enough, we're not going to go under, but... you're starting, you know, now we're seeing the same thing from Deutsche Bank, and nobody's feeling particularly comforted by it. Now, a bankrupt Deutsche, it would trigger a political crisis in Germany at the same time that the Eurozone just goes into economic meltdown. Many Germans, they're already upset about the number of migrants coming into their country. How much worse would it be after their most important bank has gone bankrupt? They're worried now about losing their own jobs, unemployment going up. They would start to say, look, there's immigrants, they're coming in, they're taking our jobs. It would vastly exacerbate that crisis. Now, though, does a bailout fix everything? Well, as we've already talked about from the Telegraph, there are big problems even with a bailout, especially at the European level, but in Germany too. Now, a bailout, it probably would be the lesser of the two evils, but it still comes with significant downsides. As we've talked about on Trumpet Hour, as Mr. Flurry has talked about on this show, at the recent Berlin elections, the fringe left-wing parties, the Green Party, the Left Party, they won about 30% of the vote. So, you know, a lot of Germans are already upset with things like bailouts. They're upset with austerity. They don't want to see their money going even to German banks. That way of doing things is already so unpopular that it's sending a third of German voters to these fringe parties that want a completely, radically, much more socialist left-wing economic system. What is a major bailout, a billion-dollar bailout of taxpayers' money going to do to that at the same time that Germany is enforcing austerity and, you know, pension reductions, etc., across the Eurozone? A lot of Germans would not be happy to see their government bailing out fat cats, as they would see it. And so the pressure on the Christian Democratic Union to get rid of Angela Merkel would just increase. At the same time, you'd have problems at the European level. Again, you'd have the European Central Bank and trying to stop or potentially hindering the bailout. Germany would blame the European, and already does blame the European Central Bank for a lot of their problems. So it would increase tension there. But the most disturbing aspect of this story comes when you put it in context with all the other worrying signs for Germany. Now, as I said, there's a lot of discussion. Will they, won't they need a bailout? You know, some people are saying, well, okay, their share price is through the floor. But actually, if you look at the amount of cash the bank has on hand, they might be okay. And there are a lot of very smart economists arguing about it. So, obviously for me, like, you know, I can't be exactly sure whether they're going to get a bailout or not. But look at it this way. You know, everybody agrees Deutsche Bank is weak, that they're in trouble, that they're struggling. And that... whether or not that's a problem within itself, it is a symptom that the global economy, global financial crisis is hitting Germany, and it is hitting hard. A symptom of a much deeper sickness within Germany that can't just be so easily cured as a bailout, as the government just throwing money at the problem. Germany's economy, it depends on exports, and this financial crisis has caused weak exports all across the world. European exports have been, or imports of German goods have been especially weak. They've not been able to buy as many goods from Germany as they used to. And so far, Germany has made up for that by buying goods from America and from China. But there's been recent news just over the last month or so showing that America is importing less. So that affects Germany directly. It also very much affects China. If America imports less from China, China has less money to import goods from Germany. So these two countries that have done a lot to stop German economy from going under by buying all of their exports are starting to cut back at the same time. A lot of that's going to cause major worries for Germany. And then at the same time, you've got these big international bodies warning about the health of the global economy. And this is something we talked about on Trumpet Hour last Friday. But you've got the Bank of International Settlements warning in its quarterly report that there's growing instability in the financial market. And Friedman writing on this, he wrote that the instability that it warns about does not seem to be cataclysmic. But given that Germany is at the heart of the earthquake, even a moderate shaking will bring it down. At the same time, the UN Conference on Trade and Development, they published a paper on September 22nd with a much more dire warning. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard had an article on that called UN Fears Third Leg of the Global Finance Crisis with the Prospect of Epic Debt Defaults. And so this is warning of, just to quote some from this article, of something that could prove to be the definitive crisis of globalized capitalism, the demise of the three market liberal orthodoxies promoted for almost 40 years. So something that could just bring down the entire financial system. So a crisis, if it was just Deutsche Bank on its own, or even in something like Deutsche Bank and Commerzbank, that would be hard enough to address with a bailout. And the bailout would be possible. It would cause big political problems, would cause problems within the Eurozone, but not necessarily unmanageable problems. But when you view the whole situation, it's clear that there's a much deeper sickness with much bigger implications. Last week, George Friedman warned, "In my view, there is a growing sense in Germany that the German system is failing. It has not yet dawned on most that excessive exports are a sign of weakness, not strength, because a country is dependent on external customers." Now, I'm not sure whether I'd entirely agree with that. He's right that it does mean that they're dependent on external customers and that downturns the rest of the world can eventually spread there. But it also means that Germany does still have a strong manufacturing base that once they've dealt with the crisis would still be there and something that can still be a great strength. But anyway, to continue, he goes on that the tremors now being felt by the finest financial analysts in the world, ordinary people who work for a living and need their paychecks to survive. Sorry, the tremors they're now being felt by those people. The political base of modern Germany is crumbling, and as in Britain with Brexit, it will be dismissed as the work of the irresponsible proles. So he warns that this could feed through to a political crisis and just really upturn German politics right at the heart of the euro. An economic crisis in the 30s, they drove Germans to vote for the Nazis, for the communists as well. Already they're voting for fringe parties like the Alternative for Deutschland and the Left Party. And as we've talked about before, it's just absolutely astonishing that about a third of Germans in Berlin voted for those two extreme, and especially the Left Party, extreme parties. And then at the same time, you know, all those economic troubles in Germany, they would open up the old wounds and questions in the euro crisis. So we're looking at a transformational crisis of Germany and for leadership. And I think it's interesting that the economists, they're already saying and talking about a problem in leadership with all this. Take a listen to just a section from this a recent interview on Bloomberg.
Professor Spence, when I look at Germany and when I look at all of this, it is a clearing of markets. It goes back to Hayek 1945, all of Friedrich Hayek. Where does the courage come from, the political will come from to clear markets?
Leadership. It comes from leadership. There has to be somebody with a clear-eyed sense of what needs to be done.
Do you see that with Merkel in Germany?
Not now, no. No, I think Merkel has provided pretty good leadership in some dimensions, but on the economic thing, she has bowed to the pressures of her fellow Germans.
So if you ignore some of the jargon there, basically what does it take to not just kick the can down the road, but to actually sort out this financial crisis, to get things on a solid foundation, to make the very painful decisions that need to be made to fix this? Well, as you heard that expert, that professor, I can't quite recall his name, but as you heard, leadership, and leadership that Ms. Merkel has not shown yet and does not have. So you're already people saying, well, what is this crisis? It's just going to keep going. It's going to keep getting worse until we have some strong leadership in Germany. And when you look at the elections, when you look at the strong support for fringe parties, you see the same thing. People are saying we need radically different leadership for our nation. And look at how the global financial crisis hit Greece. Greece is now being governed by a party that barely existed before the financial crisis hit. We've seen just in the last few years how transformational an economic crisis can be for a country. But Germany is not Greece. This is one of the world's largest exporters, I think perhaps even the largest exporter in the world. It's something that will have major, major, major global implications. And as we said, it affects Europe too. And as Mr. Stephen Flurry talked about recently on one of these programs, Herbert W. Armstrong wrote in 1984 that a massive banking crisis in America could suddenly result in triggering European nations to unite as a world power larger than either the Soviet Union or the US. So a Deutsche Bank crisis, even if bailed out, it will have major implications for Europe. And more than that, Deutsche Bank is an indication of some very serious financial crises that are still there, just papered over within Germany and Europe. So that's why this is really one of the top news stories right now. We'll take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll move on to another important story, the most worrying aspect of the US presidential debates.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
For an easy-to-read, information-rich news brief, join the growing readership of the Trumpet Weekly. Now you can enjoy all the top news stories from the previous week, condensed into a report combining the commentary, analysis, and reporting you've come to expect from thetrumpet.com, sent directly to your email. Subscribing is completely free. Simply visit the Trumpet Weekly section of thetrumpet.com to subscribe by email today.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program.
Hello, welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Stephen Flurry. Before the break, we were talking about Deutsche Bank and about some of the big problems brewing within Germany and the German economy and the massive changes that they could bring. Now I want to shift gears a bit and talk about something slightly different for a few minutes, and that is the US presidential debates. Now, I have to confess, I didn't watch them. The election, as I've said before, it does just seem to drag on an awfully long time, and it seemed hard to imagine Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton saying anything that they haven't said before. It's also in the middle of the night over here, so practically it's not... I certainly didn't feel like staying up all night to watch them. But yesterday I saw a great article from George Friedman making a simple but powerful point about the debates. It was in an article titled Wrestling Comes to the Presidency. And he wrote, "What struck me tonight was the complete absence of decorum. There was no respect for either the question or the time limit. The moderator will undoubtedly be blamed, but there was no way he could control that. He could not insist that the question he asked be answered or that the candidates shut up after a bit." So just to get a taste of what he's talking about here, here's a couple of clips of that lack of decorum from the debate.
I was against it once it was finally negotiated and the terms were laid out. I wrote about that in...
You called it the gold standard. You called it the gold standard of trade deals. You said it's the finest deal you've ever seen.
No.
And then you heard what I said about it, and all of a sudden you were against it.
Well, Donald, I know you live in your own reality, but that is not the fact.
And look at her website. You know what? It's no different than this. She's telling us how to fight ISIS. Just go to her website. She tells you how to fight ISIS on her website. I don't think General Douglas MacArthur would like that
too much. The next segment, we're continuing the subject of
ISIS. Well, at least I have a plan to fight ISIS.
Prosperity.
No, you're telling the enemy everything you want to do.
No, we're not.
See, you're telling the enemy everything you want to do. No wonder you've been fighting ISIS your entire adult life.
Folks, the fact checkers, get
folks,
to work.
Are...
So he has a long record of engaging in racist behavior. And the birther lie was a very hurtful one.
So you have candidates talking over each other, interrupting each other, calling each other racist and other names, and talking over interrupting the moderator even. The poor moderator couldn't even get a word in edgewise. And I went back and I watched some older debates, and it's a very, very different feel. Much, much less interruption. There's no Donald this or crooked Hillary Clinton. It's all much more respectful. And just an example, here's one of... It's probably the most brutal and infamous encounter in U.S. presidential debate history up to this point. But listen to this, what is by historical standards absolutely brutal, but contrast that to what we heard just a couple of minutes ago.
I have as much experience in the Congress as Jack Kennedy did when he sought the presidency.
Senator, I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
That was really uncalled for, Senator.
You're the one that was making the comparison, Senator.
So that was the vice presidential debate in 1988 between Lloyd Bentsen and Dan Quayle. And as I said, the clip is infamous. It's known as being the biggest burn in presidential debate history. And you can sense the tension, but they're still not calling each other names. The worst is that it comes to saying senator with exaggerated politeness. And then you can clearly hear that there were people that thought that this was beyond the pale. And to take a more recent example, here's just an incredibly short clip from the last lot of presidential debates in 2012.
I believe Governor Romney is a good man. Loves his family, cares about his faith.
Now, President Obama went on to mischaracterize some things that Mr. Romney had said. But my point is that even just 4 years ago, there was still a basic level of decency and respect, even if it was only superficial. And that is gone, and part of that is due to the decline in civility and decorum in societies in general. But I really liked what Friedman wrote in this article, which was to take it far beyond simply the candidates. He wrote, "The audience also felt free to ignore the rules." And that was what struck me the most. The candidates and the audience clearly didn't think the rules mattered, or that they were essential to anything as significant as presidential debate. He wrote that the debate violated all norms of civilized behavior. It was an arena of certainty and contempt, and it treated a debate on serious matters of public policy on national television as if it were a wrestling match. And the reason for this is that we, the people in general, that's the way we want it. He writes, "We have reached the point where insults, no matter how vile and how unforgivable, are not only accepted but expected by the public. Trump said that Hillary doesn't have stamina. Clinton charged him with failing to pay his workers. Nothing was out of bounds. And very little that was said mattered. At the end of the night, we can wonder who won the wrestling match, but truthfully, it didn't matter. We had our favorites, and that was that." And as Friedman wrote, this is dangerous. He writes, "The candidates were supposed to represent a truth fundamental to democratic life. As much as they might have disagreed with each other, whatever they thought privately, their public personas towards each other should be meticulously courteous, and personal charges and countercharges excluded as much as possible. The reason is simple. In a democracy, there are elections. But if the republic is to survive, the elections cannot override the fact that we are all citizens and that our agreements override our disagreements. Each candidate should be honored to support the other if he or she wins." And that's a great point. And over the last few months, in between reading a lot about geography and international relations, I've been thinking and looking into how republics end. And to that end, I've been going through a fair bit of history from the end of the Roman Republic and how it transitioned to the rule of emperors. And that's something I think it's a fascinating question. I've no idea how much history of Rome is taught in American schools. I assume a semester or two. But according to the Roman view of their own mythicized history, Rome had been ruled by a series of kings until Tarquin the Proud, or to give him his very cool full name, Lucius Tarquinius Superbus. And then under him, the Romans got so fed up of tyranny that they rose up and overthrew him. And from then on, they hated kings. The whole republican system was set up to avoid kings. The worst insult you could receive as a politician was to be accused of being a king. Scipio Africanus was the great victor over Hannibal and Carthage in the Punic Wars, you know, one of Rome's greatest ever generals, and he died a political exile because people said he was too much like a king. So how did this republic that hated kings go on to become the most famous empire in the history of the world? And today, the very word emperor in so many... Well, that's based on a Latin word, but in Germany, emperors are called kaisers. In Russia, tsars, and those words are just corruptions of the word Caesar, from Julius Caesar. And the answer to this question, I think, really comes down to the fact that democracies or republics are very fragile things. The Roman Republic was never really stable. And now I have to point out, it wasn't as democratic as the United States, and it was set up to concentrate power with the wealthy, and there were wealth requirements for sitting in the Senate. But regardless of that, throughout all its documented period of documented history, there were people assassinating their opponents, there were frequent civil wars and rebellions, people trying to set themselves up as dictators, and the Republic had basically collapsed by the time of Julius Caesar, if not before. Now, you know, I'm not American. I was never brought up to reverence the Constitution the way that a lot of, you know, it's really taught in British schools, and I doubt anyone will grudge the fact that I think Britain's constitutional arrangement is better. But in studying this history, not just of Rome, you know, that's dramatically increased my appreciation for the U.S. Constitution. To have a group of men sit down and write a bunch of rules on the way to rule a country and have it work for a couple of hundred years, I'm not certain that that's unprecedented in all of history, but I can't think of another example. It's not just Rome. Consider the French Revolution. You know, they were in a similar situation to the US at a similar time. They got rid of a monarchy, and they were saying, well, what should we do now? And they ended up going through a series of constitutions because they didn't work, and they ended up in a dictatorship and an empire ruled by Napoleon. And again, because their constitution and their republic had failed. In France, after the Republic, they had all sorts of turmoil. They ended up with a form of government that gave way too much power to just a small group of people, the Committee of Public Safety, who just pretty much went about killing everybody and executing a whole bunch of people in the Reign of Terror. Then there was a coup against them. You had the Constitution of Year 3, and that went to the opposite extreme. France, at that point, they were so afraid of giving people too much power, as they had before with that regime that had just guillotined anybody they wanted. So this time they spread power out so far and with such a wide group of people and put so many strictures on its use that they couldn't get anything done. And the government was completely ineffective. There was rampant inflation, all kinds of problems. And again, the government basically failed, and Napoleon stepped up, picked up the pieces and became dictator. So to get that balance right, giving people or bodies enough power to get something done without giving them so much power that they establish a tyranny is really hard. And so the US Constitution, it is a really remarkable document. But as Friedman wrote about today, politics, it's becoming a wrestling match. People don't care about the rules. Politicians and their supporters despise each other more than they want to uphold the Constitution. And both sides will talk about doing unconstitutional things to keep the other out of office. And that's why the animosity, the widespread disregard for the rules in the debates is so dangerous. You know, fine, it was the rules of the debates that they were disregarding, but it is because people and personalities now matter more than any rules. There is none of this respect for the Constitution and how fragile a republic really is. And this is how republics fall. Here's what Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry said about the Constitution in A Key of David in 2013.
I personally believe the Constitution of the United States is one of the most noble documents on this earth ever created by man. But you see, this Constitution is not easy to hold on to, and even the forefathers knew that people would come along and challenge the document. Benjamin Franklin said, we've given you a republic if you can keep it. But are you willing? Do we have lots of people that are willing to fight and die even for the Constitution the way they did in the beginning to establish it? And they spilled their blood to establish this document because they so wanted freedom from tyranny and freedom from human nature that would like to believe they know how to rule. Human nature believes it knows how to rule everything.
Here's another clip from that same program with Mr. Flurry just expanding on what some others have written about the importance of the Constitution and the basis of the Constitution.
Mr. Johnson said this, both in Virginia and New England, to the north, to the colonists were determined, God-fearing men. Mr. Johnson wrote, often in search of a religious toleration denied them at home. They were slaves in a sense. In that sense, who brought their families and were anxious to form and establish permanent settlements, they put political and religious freedom before riches. Thus took shape the economic dynamo that eventually became the United States, an experiment designed to establish the rule of God on earth. What's that? The rule of God on earth? These are the people that created the Constitution. They really wanted, many of them wanted to establish the rule of God on this earth. And they wrote this Constitution, and a lot of it is based on the Bible and Ten Commandments. And so those people who want to destroy the Constitution also, well, they don't have a high opinion of the Bible either, and they don't like God telling them what to do, if they even believe in God. So, well, where does that leave us? Does it leave us not at their mercy? Or at their mercy? Well, let me read to you what Earl Warren said when he was talking about religion and morality being the basis, really, of the Constitution, that you really do have to have a deep belief in God or you can't maintain it. But he said this in 1954, Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren wrote, I believe the entire Bill of Rights came into being because of the knowledge our forefathers had of the Bible and their belief in it. You see, that's where our forefathers were much superior than we are today.
Today, nobody wants God to rule. They don't even want the law to rule. They want their preferred candidate, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, to rule. And this devotion to the people and this complete disregard for rules is dangerous. And that was the most important takeaway from those presidential debates. Now, we'll take a quick break, and after the break, we'll be right back on a completely different subject.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Thank you very much for having me. Look forward to talking about the SpaceX Mars architecture. And what I really want to try to achieve here is to make Mars seem possible, make it seem as though it's something that we can do in our lifetimes, and that you can go. And is there really a way that anyone could go if they wanted to? I think that's really the important thing.
Well, welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. That was Elon Musk, the founder of SpaceX, at a talk he gave just a few years ago about going to Mars. This is something that I think we naturally find fascinating, and it was quite an exciting talk that he gave. In looking at this, I was going over an article that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry wrote a few years ago, and he talked about how when the Spirit rover landed on Mars, and I think this was over 10 years ago, in 2004, something like that, NASA had 1.5 billion hits on their website. 1.5 billion, and that's with the fewer people online 12 years or so ago. People are inspired and given hope by the Mars landing, Mr. Flurry wrote. And I think Elon Musk's project is doing something similar. My colleague Jeremiah Jacques, he wrote an article a couple of years ago about a Dutch company that put out job applications for one-way trips to Mars. Now, they were one-way trips. These people would not come back. And so this space exploration company, they weren't sure if they'd get any applications or many. And instead, they got 78,000 in just a few weeks. So Mars gives us hope. Projects about going to Mars are something that can really inspire and motivate people. And there's a lot about Elon Musk's projects that are very exciting. You know, his approach is, I want to go to Mars in my lifetime. What needs to change to make that happen? And then more than that, he wants to colonize Mars, to settle Mars. And this speech, I think he gave it on September 27th, if I remember correctly. And it wasn't about, well, I have a dream about going to Mars. Instead, it was, here is what my engineers are working on right now to set up a manned colony of around 1 million people on Mars. And his approach was, well, to set up a large colony, it needs to become much, much cheaper to get there. And so he set the goal of making it so that a trip to Mars would cost around the same price as a medium-sized house, or I've no idea how much houses cost in America, but around $200,000. So he wants to bring the price down from a few billion, or, well, not even possible right now, to $200,000 a person. So his plan involves a huge relaunchable vehicle that would be able to put a whole bunch of interplanetary vehicles in orbit and to carry fuel up to them and refuel them in orbit around the Earth. These vehicles would be capable of about carrying 200 people. And every 2 years, when Earth and Mars were closest, these interplanetary vehicles would travel to Mars. They'd land on Mars, then they'd manufacture rocket fuel on Mars and then send them home to then come back and take more people to Mars. And it's an exciting vision of man living on a new planet. He kind of painted a picture where you'd gradually build thousands of these vehicles, and within a period of time, to somewhere between 40 to 100 years, you'd build up a self-sustaining colony of around 1 million people. And then it gets even more exciting when he talks about setting up refueling stations all around the solar system and traveling all across it.
So then what about beyond Mars? So as we thought about the system, and the reason we call it a system, because generally I don't like calling things systems because everything's a system, including your dog, is that it's actually more than a vehicle. There's obviously the rocket booster, the spaceship, the tanker, and the propellant plant, the in-situ propellant production. If you have all of those four elements, you can actually go anywhere in the solar system by planet hopping or moon hopping. So by establishing a propellant depot in the asteroid belt or on one of the moons of Jupiter, you can make flights from Mars to Jupiter, no problem. In fact, even without a propellant depot at Mars, you can do a flyby of Jupiter without a propellant depot. But by establishing a propellant depot, let's say Enceladus or Europa or any of this few options, and then doing another one on Titan, Saturn's moon, and then perhaps another one further out on Pluto or elsewhere in the solar system. This system really gives you freedom to go anywhere you want in the greater solar system. So you can actually travel out to the Kuiper Belt, to the Oort cloud. I wouldn't recommend this for interstellar journeys, but this basic system, provided we have filling stations along the way, means full access to the entire greater solar system.
That that's an exciting vision. I mean, at the moment, we barely know what the Kuiper Belt or the Oort clouds look like right now. They're so far away, but he's talking about working on a project that could get us there. And Musk's work, you know, it helps make it more real and practical. They're designing these ships. They've worked out what fuel they want to use. They're testing the engines they'd use on it. He decided the hardest part would be to build a tank to hold all the liquid oxygen that they've need. So they've built one already so that they can work on it and work out how to do it. So it's a practical, real plan. But can it work? Well, as we get into that, note Elon Musk's reason for wanting to go to Mars.
I mean, first of all, why go anywhere, right? I think there are really two fundamental paths. History is going to bifurcate along two directions. One path is we stay on Earth forever, and then there will be some eventual extinction event. I don't have an immediate doomsday prophecy, but eventually history suggests there will be some doomsday event. The alternative is to become a space-faring civilization and a multi-planet species, which I hope you would agree that is the right way to go.
A few years ago, he spelt it out more explicitly, and he said, "I don't think we can discount the possibility of a third world war." He talked about in 1912, they're proclaiming a new age of peace and prosperity, saying it was a golden age, war was over. And then you had World War I, followed by World War II. He said, "So I think we need to acknowledge there's a certain possibility of a third world war, and if that does occur, it could be far worse than anything that happened before." He said, "You back up your hard drive, maybe we should back up life too. So we need to go to Mars in case we wipe ourselves out on Earth." And that is a big reason why we get excited about Mars. You know, Earth has problems, Mars is a clean slate. We could think, well, let's go there, set up our perfect society from scratch. And in 2008, the late author Ray Brown, he wrote, "I suspect that the obsession with space exploration is a kind of subterranean fear that things are getting too hot down here, so now is the time to look for that Shangri-La. And if we just get up there, a few of us will escape the trouble that we're having down here." But if we look at that soberly, you know, that doesn't solve our problems. We'd have the same human nature, we'd bring the same problems to Mars, to everywhere. And even if we could colonize it, which is a huge if, you know, Musk is pretty much dealing solely with the transport, and there are huge other problems aside, like just practical problems aside from that. But would that solve things like war? Or would we just spread that to another planet? In that article I mentioned earlier, Mr. Fleury wrote, "Look at what man has done to this planet. We're about to destroy all human life on Earth. We were given a beautiful Earth, and look what we've done with it. Could we now take a Mars wasteland and make it flourish with life? First, we must change human nature." And he's right. Change human nature. And once we've done that and fixed our problems down here, then we can go. Then we'll be able to go up and bring that life to Mars. And that is the good news about this. You know, we get excited about exploring space, and that is good. Ultimately, God wants mankind to be on Mars and far beyond. And Isaiah 45, verse 8, talks about how God created the heavens, he formed the earth, he created it not in vain, he formed it to be inhabited. Not just the earth to be inhabited, but the heavens too. Hebrews 2 verses 6 to 10 talks about how God will put the universe in subjection to mankind. And here's what Mr. Fleury had to say about a different scripture in the Key of David program on this subject.
But I want to take a look today at God's space program. And let's turn, first of all, to Isaiah 51 and verse 16 and read that most inspiring expression. Verse 16, "And I have put my words in your mouth and have covered you in the shadow of my hand, that I may plant the heavens and lay the foundations of the earth and say unto Zion, you are my people." Now, that's God's church, and this is God's plan for man. For everybody is going to be a part of His church in time. But He says, "I want to use you as my family to plant the heavens." What does that mean, to plant the heavens? To plant the universe as well as the earth and make it all look like a Garden of Eden, as it mentions in verse 3. But the word plant means just to plant like a tree or a garden. To plant and give roots to a certain beauty that will be happening and occurring on those planets in the very near future. God's plan, you see, is to send man to outer space, to Mars, and all of the universe, to plant the heavens. To plant the heavens. Now, the more I think about that expression, the more I am in awe of it, because, of course, man has to be sent out there to restore the universe to the condition it was in before Satan rebelled, but also to beautify it far beyond that. That's why we're here on this earth, and what it's our calling is all about. We're going to be doing that as God's family.
So that is the good that can come from Musk's project. This is our real future. And you know, his practical preparations for that does help that make that come alive and be more real to us. Now, it's not going to happen the way that Musk thinks. It's not going to be his project that brings mankind to Mars. God will need to fix mankind's human nature first, but it does help that vision become real to us. That's about it from me today. If you'd like to know more about this, we have a great full-color booklet, Our Awesome Universe Potential. You can look at thetrumpet.com for more information on anything that we've talked about today. You've been listening to KPCG. This is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Email us any thoughts at td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for listening.